Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. And we have on our show today with us Dennis Wagner, the Executive Director of the Access Research Network. We've had Dennis on the show a number of times before. As a matter of fact, we usually have him on the show around the beginning of the year to talk about the top 10 Darwin and Design science stories from the previous year. So we have Dennis on the phone with us right now talking about the top 10 Darwin and Design science stories from the year 2011. So Dennis, thanks a lot for coming back on the show with us.
Glad to be here, Casey. I always look forward to this time of year. It's fun to see the progress over the past 12 months and take a kind of a macro look at what's happened in the last year.
I appreciate what you say, and I certainly feel the same way. We often get so bogged down in the day-to-day, and it's great to see that over the course of a year, a lot of really interesting new science stories come out, and a lot of accomplishments are achieved in the ID movement. Really quick before we jump into this, you are the executive director of the Access Research Network, or ARN.org. ARN is a distinct and separate organization from Discovery Institute, but it's actually probably the oldest ID organization out there. Is that correct, Dennis?
I think so. I started this back in my college days, which was in the late 70s. Back then we were called Students for Origins Research, but in the 90s we kind of reorganized. And early 90s is when Philip Johnson was making a name for himself with Darwin on Trial and some other things. And we got involved in promoting some of his videos and books. So it's been 20 plus years since we've been focused on the ID issue.
Well, and speaking of videos and books, ARN.org probably has the largest online book and video store for getting ID-related materials. So I want our listeners to know that if you're looking for a great place to find not just, you know, the big books like Darwin's Black Box, you can find a lot of the lesser-known books at the ARN.org bookstore and also videos as well. Am I correct in what I'm saying, Dennis?
Yeah, we have over 50 books and I think 50 videos on various aspects of intelligent design and design in nature, those types of things. And most of our material are books that we've selected to be appropriate for use in kind of the public domain, public school environment, university environment, those types of things. So that's kind of our focus area.
And your bookstore specializes in ID evolution-related materials. So definitely go check it out. With that, let's get into the top 10 Darwin and Design science stories for 2011. Dennis, let's just go backwards here, starting with number 10. What was the number 10 Darwin and Design science story from last year?
Well, it was an article published by a philosophy professor on the limits to self-organization. And this was really key because self-organization has become kind of the new calling card for the Darwinians trying to explain the origin of life. Previously, it was theories about the prebiotic soup and those kinds of things. They've now given up on those theories, and they're looking to the self-organizing capability of material to explain how life arose. And there's some sense to that because we see things that have some self-organizational capability like crystals that will form and have a structure to them. But what Professor Richard Johns came up with in his article was a limitative theorem in which he said that the laws of nature can only self-organize to a certain point. And so this is kind of key. He says there's a limit to that. And just as there are logical limits to the amount of information that can be derived from a given set of premises, there's also physical limits the kinds of structures that can be derived from a given set of physical laws. And he really feels that this put constraints on what natural selection can do from the raw materials.
And we had Richard Johns on the ID the Future podcast last year talking about his paper. It really conforms nicely to some of Dembski's ideas about conservation of information. Professor Johns is saying that you can't get more information out of something than is already in it. So yeah, maybe self-organization can do some things, but it's not going to produce an information level that's more than what the system already had at the beginning. And his limitative theorem is very in line with a lot of the sort of ID thinking that's been out there. Although he doesn't say that it specifically proves ID, he says it is it limits the abilities of forces like natural selection and self-organization theories.
I think it puts a nice boundary on some of the Darwinian just-so stories, you know, they come up with to explain how things happened, and they're just way outside the bounds of what happens in nature. So I think that's an exciting step.
Let's move to the number 9 story. DNA repair mechanisms reveal a contradiction in evolutionary theory. What can you tell us about this?
Well, we know that digital codes in computers are programmed to have a self-correcting nature. So when an error occurs in a digital communication, you can program it to correct that error on the fly. And they've discovered that nucleotide codes and cells have the same kind of protection mechanism inside their very complex error correction mechanisms. And this is seldom accounted for in theories of evolution that depend on mutations happening and accumulating over a period of time, but they don't account for the fact that a lot of those mutations will be corrected by the system itself. And so this paper that appeared in the February issue of the Open Evolution Journal, the authors explore how the mutation protection affects the random changes in both digital codes and nucleotide codes. And they illustrate their findings with a computer simulation of the evolution of population of self-replicating digital amoeba. So they're actually able to show through a digital simulation the effect that self-correcting codes would have on changes in a system. There's another limiting factor on what natural selection can do with mutations for creating new entities.
Well, the number 8 story is one that I thought was very interesting. You called it an identity crisis for human ancestors, talking about difficulty in identifying exactly who are our ancestors. What can you tell us about this story, Dennis?
Over the past decade, there have been multiple discoveries that the media claim the earliest known human has been found. And what these authors have done is, in a February 17th issue of Nature, done a review of all these findings over the last decade. This was Bernard Wood and Terry Harrison. And in their paper, they caution that history has shown how uncritical reliance on a few similarities between fossil apes and humans can lead to incorrect assumptions about evolutionary relationships. They point to the case of Ramapithecus, a species of fossil ape in South Asia, which was mistakenly assumed to be an early human ancestor in the 60s and 70s, but later found to be a close relative of the orangutan. And so they take that as a case point example, and they apply the same reasoning to these three finds in the last 10 years. And they have alternative explanations that they feel that these fossils can all be interpreted more into the ape category than the human category. And so it's just an example of overexcitement and overreading the evidence to come to the conclusion that they want to. And, you know, based on some of these findings, scientists are calling for an end to what some people call ancestor worship, where they're just out to find the earliest human ancestor, and so they overextend the evidence to be able to claim that fact.
I really appreciated this story, Dennis, because we had been hearing the pro-evolution media beating people over the head with these recent fossil finds like Ardipithecus ramidus, saying, this is the last common ancestor of humans and chimpanzees, or this is unquestionably a human ancestor. And this story by Wood and Harrison made it clear that some of the phylogenetic characters, they could not tell whether it was a human ancestor or not. It was not clear. And additionally, it talked about a very interesting fact that basically we have examples in the fossil record of apes that were upright walking that had no ancestral relationship to modern humans. And these are apes that go back maybe 10 or so million years ago, long before the supposed line of hominids developed that led to humans. And so what these fossils show is that you can have upright walking bipedal apes in the fossil record that have nothing to do with an alleged line that's evolving towards human bipedality. So basically, just because you find an ape in the fossil record that walks upright, that doesn't mean that it is a transitional form leading towards the human lineage. Definitely, it was a vindication of many of the arguments we have been saying about the overhyped nature of these fossils that have been discovered over the last few years. Dennis, I know that you told me that the number 5 and number 6 stories both go together, and that is the golden orb weaver fossil spider provides new evidence for stasis, as well as another paper about the fossil record. This is a paper about the explosive radiation of flowering plants being confirmed, what has often been called the big bloom. So can you tell us about these two stories, number 5 and 6?
Yeah, the golden orb weaver fossil is actually a female species that previously was found about 35 million years ago. And this fossil that was discovered was 165 million years ago. And so it pushes back over 135 million years the complexity of this particular spider. This is an interesting spider. I encourage you to follow the link on our top 10 stories, which can be downloaded from our website. By the way, I should mention that at arn.org/top10, top 10. And we have links to more detail on this. If you click on the link, you'll see a picture of this fossilized spider, which was almost 6 inches in diameter. If you hold your hand out and spread it out, a typical hand is about 6 to 7 inches across. So think of a spider that big and finding that in your bathroom. You know, it's enough to keep you awake at night. Anyway, the incredible detail of this fossil, it had even fine hairs on its leg and everything, revealed that it's very, very similar to the living golden orb weavers that find today, which are a little bit larger. They're around 7 inches or so, but still very, very similar. And so here again, we see this complexity and this fully developed, very advanced spider very far back in the fossil record, which takes us to number 5 story of the flowering plants on the March issue of Nature. Talked about a striking discovery of beautiful, mature flowering plant in China. And this is very much like the modern buttercup flowers. And you can see like 5 or 6 leaves, and you can actually see the flower itself in this fossil find. This is another one where a picture's worth 1,000 words. Looking at that fossil is amazing. But the age of this particular flower is approximately 124 million years ago, and the earliest flowering plants represented by pollen grains considered to be about 130 million years ago. And so we go from pollen grains to this fully developed buttercup flower in a mere 6 million years in the fossil record, which again just seems incredible for what the Darwinian process has to accomplish in that time period. So again, we have the appearance of complexity appearing in the universe earlier than thought, and the fossil record with spiders and the fossil record with flowering plants, you know, just confirming again that there was a lot of complexity very early in the Earth and universe history.
Let's move to the number 4 story, Dennis, which is about a paper published by Doug Axe and some other scientists in the journal Biocomplexity just a few months ago. We covered this story here on ID the Future. And I should add that this paper was published by ProID scientists who are trying to design simulations so that they can test questions related to Darwinian evolution and intelligent design. You titled this story, Stylus Aims to Bridge Gap Between Real World and Artificial Evolutionary Simulations. And I think this is a very interesting story in that the Stylus program that Doug Axe and his co-workers have created is trying to create a more accurate simulation of the evolutionary processes so that we can actually assess evolutionary questions using computer simulations in a more realistic way. What else can you tell us about this story, Dennis?
Modeling and simulation is a very important tool in engineering and science, and it's used all the time, but you have to be very careful about your assumptions that you use in your modeling, or you can come up with completely erroneous results. You know, examples I can think of that people might relate to is our models for the Earth's climate and global warming, those kinds of things. There's a wide range of answers that come out of those models, from the fact that people are predicting, you know, the whole Earth will be under 100 inches of water in 100 years, to all the way to the other extreme that we don't have any problems at all. So again, the initial conditions and assumptions you make in modeling are important. And that's really played a big factor in the evolutionary models that people have come up with. And Dembski and Doug Axe and others have shown that some of those assumptions are wrong in the evolutionary models. And of course, these models have been used to validate Darwin's theory over the last 10 years. So what Doug Axe and his team are trying to do is show that, you know, we really need to tie the modeling to what we find in biology. And the closer we can do that, the more we can believe that model. In his Stylus program, I found interesting, uses Chinese characters as digital objects. And so he says we only have something really functional out of our model if it produces a true Chinese character that can communicate information. There'll be a lot more work, I believe, coming out of this group with their Stylus tool, but they've made this tool free to the public, and I think it really improves the methods of evolutionary modeling.
Yeah, one of the unique aspects of the Stylus program is they think that Chinese characters have a close analogy to the shapes of proteins. So by trying to evolve Chinese characters, they can model many of the aspects of the shape that make up functional proteins, and they've got a very useful analog there for modeling biological reality. Let's move to the third top story, Dennis, which is woodpecker drumming inspires a shock-absorbing system. Many folks that follow ID Arguments might be aware of sort of the amazing design of woodpeckers. But there was a story that came out this last year that elaborated on this. What can you tell us about this, Dennis?
This fits in the whole area of biomimetics, which is a growing field where biologists and engineers are trying to reverse engineer some of the incredible designs we find in nature and recreate that in kind of our own physical realm. And there are probably 100 different stories that we could have reported on. We just picked one, and I think the woodpecker's an interesting one because, as you know, if you've been out in the woods, a woodpecker typically pounds his beak into the tree about 18 to 22 times per second, which is, you know, a lot of pounding with a deacceleration of 1,200 Gs. If we tried doing that, if you tried pounding your head into a tree 18 to 22 times a minute, you'd probably black out after not too long. And so they were wondering, you know, what is it about the design of the woodpecker that is able to take this kind of force and not have brain damage? So there's actually two different teams in China that are studying this, and one was able to understand it enough to start designing a shock-absorbing system for micro-machine devices to help it with deacceleration forces. And then there's another team that's trying to design a better helmet for human protection based on this design that they find in woodpeckers.
And the number two story, Dennis, is also looking at the sort of amazing design of an organism. That is the design of the butterfly, which you said it continues to inspire and amaze. We've obviously talked a lot about butterfly design and insect design over the last year with a new documentary, Metamorphosis, coming out. But what can you tell us about this story, Dennis?
There were two scientific publications that came out. One in New Scientist that talked about Harvard's microrobotics lab, where inventors were trying to basically create a butterfly. And they were trying to do the same size and weight parameters. And they couldn't get it to work. And they said, well, the real butterfly has veined wings. Maybe that's there for a reason. So let's try that. And they found that that did provide enough lift to fly their butterfly, which is powered by a rubber band, by the way. But it's the first flying insect replica that really matches the real thing in size and weight. And then there's another group of scientists that discovered that the swallowtail butterflies, like the monarchs that are featured in the Metamorphosis DVD that you talked about, also have an array of sensors on their forelegs that they use to drum the leaves and sense the chemical content of the leaves, because it turns out that's very important for the larva after you laid on a certain type of leaf for their food source. And again, this is documented in a DVD, which I highly recommend. It even goes into more detail about the design of the butterfly. And so again, here's another case of biomimetics where we're reverse engineering the butterfly and learning things about flight, learning things about chemical sensors, and all sorts of interesting things.
Okay, well, let's get the drum roll out for the number one story in Darwin and Design Science News for 2011. I think this was a very worthy story that you chose, Dennis, something that we've talked a little bit about here on Evolution News and ID the Future, and we're going to be talking more about this in the coming weeks, I can guarantee you that. But this is the 50th peer-reviewed Pro-ID scientific paper being published. We hear all the time from critics that ID movement does no research, that there are no peer-reviewed papers. And we're not going to deny that there's a need for more papers and more research to come out. But I think it is significant that 2011 was the year that the ID movement published its 50th peer-reviewed scientific paper. Dennis, can you elaborate a little bit on this and tell us a little bit more what this means and what happened?
As we talked about earlier, the ID movement is about 20 years old. And so, you know, we wouldn't expect to have hundreds or thousands of scientific papers published, but
especially, Dennis, when we don't get government grant money, which flows pretty freely for evolutionary research. So we definitely don't have the same level of funding to do the research as, you might say, the Darwinian community
has.
Well,
that's one big factor. The second big factor is those that are in control of the scientific publications usually don't support the ID position. It's ideologically 180 degrees from their own position, so it's hard to get papers published in some of these journals. But I think as we're doing better and better science, and we've got people with impressive credentials doing this research, we're making headway in that. Articles have been published in Protein Science, the Journal of Molecular Biology, Quarterly Review of Biology, Cell Biology International, just to mention a few. And then the ID community itself has started a new journal, Biocomplexity, which is peer-reviewed, and that also has helped the case for getting some of this research published. I think the other big factor has been the startup of a couple of research labs, the Biologic Institute, headed by molecular biologist Doug Axe and his team there, as well as the Evolutionary Informatics Lab, founded by Bill Dembski and Robert Marks. So we have these labs now that, you know, are funded to pursue some of this research and also bringing on graduate students, and I think that's going to continue to snowball in the future.
Okay, and we're going to have more to say on this in the coming weeks, so I'm going to cut it off here, Dennis. We really appreciate the work that you guys do at the Access Research Network and also compiling these stories every year. I don't think I mentioned the URL earlier, but the URL that our listeners can go to is www.arn.org/top10. That's arn.org/top. The number 10, and you can find these stories on the website as well as a press release and a further description. So, Dennis, anything else we should add for our listeners?
It's been an exciting year, and it's fun to look back and see the progress, and I look forward to 2012.
Well, I feel the same way, and we always appreciate you coming on the show. This is ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.